When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
The Korean War, quote-unquote, ended exactly 50 years ago at Panmunjom. On July 27, 1953, United States and United Nations commanders on one side and the North Koreans and Chinese commanders on the other agreed to an immediate cessation of hostilities. Most histories of the Korean War stop there. Yet the war ended in a truce, not a proper peace agreement. The specter of conflict has loomed over the Korean Peninsula in the five decades since, changing development in both North and South Korea as each tries to secure their own future amidst a conflict that, in theory, could return at any point. Today, we're joined by Michael J. Seth, who joins the show to talk about this development and his latest book, Korea at War, Conflicts That Shaped the World, published by Tuttle. The book is about much more than just the war itself, as Seth looks at Korea's pre- and post-war history, now South Korea is unique in charting its own development while still, technically, in a state of war. Michael J. Seth is Professor of History at James Madison University. He has authored several books on Korean history, including A History of Korea from Antiquity to the Present, A Concise History of Modern Korea from the 19th Century to the Present, and Education Fever, Politics, Society, and the Pursuit of Schooling in South Korea. So, Michael, thank you for joining us on the Asian Review of Books podcast today. I think before we start getting into kind of the 20th century history of Korea, I want to ask, what do you think is missing from the way, regular people, the layperson, talks about Korea and the Korean War?
Well, those are really two different topics. One, the Korean War and Korea. As far as the Korean War is concerned, people don't talk about it very much. It has been called the Forgotten War, and it has been. It was overshadowed by World War II that preceded it by just 5 years and by other conflicts such as the Vietnam War that occurred some years later. And it is surprising how little people know or how little interest there is in the Korean War, considering this a major conflict, and it's the only conflict since World War II in which two major world powers were fighting each other, the United States and China. In spite of that fact, it's surprisingly little known.
And then how does this lack of knowledge, lack of understanding about the Korean War affect, again, the average person's understanding of Korean history?
Well, because they don't realize how important that war was, and they also don't realize that the war's not over. All there was in 1953 was a ceasefire. I think perhaps that is the most important fact. North and South Korea remain technically at war, and as such, it is the longest war in modern history. And the fact that North and South Korea have been continuously at war for 70-some years, and I would say the war technically started in 1950, but they were actually fighting each other even before that. I would say the war began in 48, and that would make it a 75-year war. And the fact that those two countries have been at war for 75 years is important in understanding that. And why is that important? Well, first there's North Korea. North Korea strikes most people as the world's strangest, weirdest country, and I think in many ways it is. But it is also a problem. It's a serious problem that we have difficulty solving, a source of instability in the world. And South Korea is an amazing success story. It's really unprecedented. A country so poor as South Korea, in a couple of generations, becoming one of the world's wealthiest, most technically advanced countries and a major source of world culture.
So let's start talking about the history. And I like to start with the Japanese occupation, colonization of Korea. You know, you make a point in your book that the experience of Koreans under the Japanese have led the Japanese to be people still have very strong negative feelings about the Japanese because of the occupation and what happened there, which plays out even today with some of the disputes between South Korea and Japan, even though they both exist under the U.S. security umbrella. But I guess what was the Japanese colonization of Korea actually like, and why has it made such a mark on Koreans even today?
Well, it was a humiliating experience for the Koreans, but let's just look at Japanese colonialism. It was a little different than the average imperialism, and I want to point out that imperialism is always an unpleasant experience for the people who are dominated by the imperialists. I think we forget how brutal imperialism is because when it gives one group of people, one nation, almost total freedom to do what they please with another people's, and that all doesn't usually bring out the best in people. The Dutch were very often very brutal and used forced labor in Indonesia. The British and the French regularly used forced labor. We could talk about the Belgians and the Congo being especially brutal. But as far as the Japanese, they were probably no worse in forms in terms of brutality, insensitivity to local culture and peoples and their needs, and exploitative than most imperialists. But unlike almost anywhere else, the Japanese left a deep, deep bitterness among North and South Korean people. In fact, that's one thing that all Koreans can, North and South can agree on, is the Japanese were really terrible. So why is that? And I think there's several reasons for it. And that Japanese imperialism was kind of unusual. One is that unlike, let's say, French or British imperialism or American imperialism in the Philippines, it was not a remote, distant peoples that were who had conquered, essentially, and occupied Korea, but it was a next-door neighbor, someone that was familiar to Korean people, that they had long experience with, including previous attempts by the Japanese to invade and conquer Korea. So in a way, it was more like the German occupation of France. It was considered by Koreans an occupation by an aggressive and long feared neighbor. So it made it a little different. Another thing that was different about it was the Japanese pursued a policy of forced assimilation. They made an attempt, essentially, to eliminate a sense of Korean identity altogether. This is rather unusual. It was not a consistent policy, but it was a policy that became more central to the Japanese enterprise in Korea in the later years of the occupation, especially in the 30s and early 1940s. What do I mean by that? Well, Koreans were actually forced to change their names to Japanese names. They were forced to register at Shinto shrines, and Shintoism has nothing to do with Korea. It's a totally alien religion. Korean language publications and newspapers were banned. Korean students could be punished for speaking their own language in the school. And Koreans were told that they were really always part of Japan, that they were the same people that somehow got separated and now are being united together. And this, of course, was this was a very traumatic to an ancient, distinctive, proud people with a rising sense of nationalism, as was the case with Korea. There is one other element I could say about it that's also a little different as well, is that Korea is a very homogeneous society. There were no significant ethnic minorities before the at the time of the Japanese occupation of the country, which took place between 1905 and 1910. And Koreans had been an independent, unified state. You look at most of the former colonies, Indonesia, there was never a place called Indonesia until it was created by the Dutch as the, in the form of the Dutch East India, or Nigeria, well, creation of the British. Korea was different. Korea was a country that was unified in the 7th century, making it older than any state in Europe. And it had its own language, its own cultural traditions, its own sense of identity, its own writing system. So the Koreans, and it was a country that was fairly isolated and not used to the presence of any foreigner for any reason in the country, let alone a foreign occupier. So all those things, I think, contribute to the fact that the Koreans had a very intense resentment against the Japanese. And I want to add one thing to that. Both North and South Korea, both governments have actually used this as a way to establish the legitimacy of their regimes. In other words, Koreans are continually taught about how horrible the Japanese are. And if you watch any, if you watch enough Korean movies or television shows, you'll whenever they show something in the colonial period, the Japanese are always unmitigatedly evil, sinister people. And so this is perpetuated by popular culture, but also by government intentionally as a way of building a sense of national identity through a shared suffering and grievance towards the Japanese.
Of course, the Japanese are then defeated in the Second World War. Korea becomes independent, though split between North and South. I mean, how did the end of the Second World War really put the two Koreas, start them on these different trajectories?
Well, Korea was partitioned by the United States and the Soviet Union. It had nothing to do with Koreans. Koreans didn't even know about it. At the closing days of World War II, the United States actually came up with an idea of partitioning the country along the 38th parallel, a line that was has no basis in history or geography. It was just a line on a map that conveniently divided the peninsula into two roughly equal size halves. And it was a totally arbitrary line. It cut across the middle of provinces. It divided valleys, divided villages, it divided families, and had there was no basis. There was no separate Northern or Southern Korean culture. And it was done without the knowledge of any Korean. No Korean was consulted in this, and the Koreans didn't even know about it until weeks after World War II ended. So that's how there are two Koreans. And the division of Korea, it should be understood, was totally unacceptable to all Koreans. The Koreans, the one thing the Koreans shared at the end of World War II was a desire to have their traditional state, maybe not the traditional government or way of life, but the historic Korean state restored as a sovereign nation. And the division of the country by foreigners was something that no Korean could accept.
So you noted in the answer to my first question that North and South Korea started to fight in 1948. Now, I mean, the quote-unquote official start of the Korean War is when North Korea invades in 1950. But what's actually happening in those years before the Korean War, again, quote-unquote, officially starts? How were how were these two countries engaging with each other, I guess both diplomatically and militarily, before the war begins?
Well, neither government, and remember, these governments were set up. The North Korean government, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, was created by the Soviet Union. Even the constitution was written by them. It was written in Russian and translated in Korean, and say, here's your constitution, here's your government, right? And the United States wasn't quite as heavy-handed as that, but largely South Korea was the creation of the United States Republic of Korea. But it was not anything that Koreans wanted. They each government considered itself the legitimate government of the whole peninsula. And to give you an idea, the constitution of North Korea stated that Seoul was the capital. In fact, the name Seoul just means the capital city in Korea, Seoul. And so the North Koreans could hardly say that our capital is anything other than the capital. So Pyongyang was considered just a temporary, in fact, a term that the North Koreans used from 1948, it was the base camp until the completion of unification and liberation is done. So therefore, from the very beginning, the aim of North Korea was to continue the struggle, first the struggle against the Japanese, and now the struggle to unify and restore the state. The South Korea said the same thing. The South Korea, when they created the first National Assembly, had 300 seats, 200 from the North representatives and 200 from representatives from the South, Southern districts, and 100 from the North. They let 100 remain empty, but they still technically they were part of the National Assembly. South Korea never regarded itself as a South Korean state, but the state of all of Korea. And the slogan of the first government of South Korea, 1948, Syngman Rhee, was March North, right? And that's what he planned to do as soon as he could finish the liberation of the country. So it was a volatile, unworkable, unrealistic idea to have two separate Koreas when it was totally unacceptable to all Koreans.
So I think in our, again, kind of when we talk about the Korean War, we tend to focus on people like MacArthur, people like on the Chinese side, Peng Dehui. Maybe they talk about Syngman Rhee and Kim Il-sung as kind of the leaders of the both Koreas. But you don't actually hear that much about the Koreans that fight. It's always about the Americans, and it's always about the Chinese fighting the Americans. But who are some of the major figures in Korea on either side, either North or South, that played a big role?
Well, there was one dominant figure in each, we'll start with the North. The North, of course, was Kim Il-sung. Kim Il-sung was a young guerrilla fighter and an anti-Japanese independence fighter from Manchuria in the 1930s and early 40s, who had become an officer in the Red Army during World War II and was centrally selected by the Soviet occupiers to be the great leader, the little Stalin, as they called they jokingly referred to them at the time, of the new North Korean state. And he was a soldier, he was a fighter, and to him it was just, his purpose was to finish the job and unify the country. But there was another very important figure in North Korea. That was a man named Park Hon-yong. And Park Hon-yong is so colorful that the stories about it are really interesting. He was actually the leader of the underground Communist Party. And he was from the South, not from the North. And I should point out that it wasn't North Koreans against South Koreans. It was Koreans that supported the regime in the North against Koreans supported the regime in the South. Most of the officers of the South Korean army were actually from the North, and many of the leaders of the North were from the South. They had, so I want to point that out. And Park Hwan-yong was convinced that the South Korean people would support any North Korean invasion. And we know this because we have the telegrams and letters and flying back and forth. And he certainly managed to convince both Kim Il-sung and Stalin and Mao as well that there was sufficient support in the South for a unification. So they're really key figures. In the South, Syngman Rhee was so determined to occupy the North that the United States did not trust him and would not give him any weapons. They would not give him any tanks. They would not give him any planes, and even the few artillery pieces they put under control of American officers because they didn't trust him. They thought he would invade the North as soon as he could, and he was determined to unify the country. He was also a staunch anti-communist and a nationalist hero, by the way. Both Kim Il-sung and Syngman Rhee had legitimate nationalist, anti-Japanese credentials and were respected by many Korean people for that reason. There were other people in the South, but I would say Syngman Rhee is the dominant figure. There are several generals, the two Pak brothers, both from North Korea, from the Pyongyang, actually, were key because they were really determined to reunite the country and were quite aggressive and probably provoked a lot of incidences, hoping to start a war. But those are some of the key people.
I have one more question on the war itself. I know the book's about much more than the Korean War. But, you know, you mentioned, again, in the book that the war could have ended much earlier. Obviously if MacArthur hadn't driven the North Koreans all the way up to the Chinese border, the Korean War might have ended years earlier. It might not have had the years of stalemate at the end. Would the history of Korea have been different if the war had ended several years earlier?
Well, that's a counterfactual question. What if? We never know what if, but I don't think anything short of unification would have brought about a permanent peace. I think it's an unstable situation. To have a country where there was such a strong sense of being one people divided into two opposing regimes. I don't think that was sustainable. I think as far as just bloodshed, after the success of the Incheon landing, by the end of September of 1950, the war had only been going on, 4 months by that time. And if the North Korean army was defeated, and if MacArthur had decided that we should accept that and work out a peace, he would have probably gotten a peace at that time. The Chinese had warned the U.S. that they would not tolerate American troops on their border and warned them not to invade the North. He decided, well, he defeated the North Koreans, let's liberate the North. And of course, that's exactly what the South Koreans, especially Syngman Rhee, wanted there. They wanted to unify. In fact, the South Koreans never waited for permission. This is a little known fact about the South, about the Korean War. Even before MacArthur got Truman's approval, Truman's got the UN blessing for invasion of the North, Syngman Rhee already sent South Korean troops into the North. He wasn't going to wait for anybody's permission. So, it's possible that it would have been hard to contain the South Koreans' army, but I think you could have contained it if you really tried and brought the war to an end. But it would have remained tense, and it doesn't mean that fighting wouldn't have broken out later.
So you mentioned obviously that again, kind of throughout this interview, that the war doesn't end. It's only a ceasefire. It's only a truce. And so I guess as North and South Korea continue to develop, I guess the war continues to kind of loom over both countries' heads. I mean, how does the war, and I guess it's how it's technically still continuing, how does that affect the development and divergence of North and South Korea?
Yeah, that's a good question. And to me, that's what is the most interesting part of this whole conflict between North and South Korea. You got to really look at these two countries. They're both rather extraordinary. I don't think most people realize how unusual both North and South Korea are. Maybe North Korea, but they don't realize how unusual South Korea. If you look at these two countries, you have nothing like this in history. No other comparison. You have a ancient, unified, homogeneous society that's been arbitrarily cut in half, and they develop in two generations radically different societies. There's no place in the world where two countries border one another that are as different as North and South Korea. There's no other place where two countries border each other where one country has 20 times the per capita income of the other. There's no two examples of countries that are one of the freest and most democratic in the world borders the most authoritarian state in the world. There's just, you don't see that. And how did that happen? How did they evolve so differently and so unusually? North Korea became the most closed, isolated. I mean, no place is as isolated in North Korea. It's the only place in the world not connected to the World Wide Web. It's the only place in the world where they don't sell Coca-Cola. It really is a closed, isolated world in itself. And it's also very authoritarian. It's a very totalitarian state. It's a poverty-stricken country. It's estimated that at least 40% of the children are stunted from malnutrition in the country. That's a figure that you don't even have in the poorest countries in Africa. That's a shocking thing. And yet, this is a country that is so poor, and yet it has intercontinental ballistic missiles. It has missiles that is launched from submarines, and has a nuclear stockpile. This is quite extraordinary. I don't have any example of a country so poor and yet having such a sophisticated military armory. So this is a very strange country. And this cult of personality, a rule by a royal family, very, very unique in North Korea. And then South Korea, again, I would point out that I can't think of another example in history of a country like South Korea. South Korea in 1960 had a per capita income the same as Haiti, and it was considered like Haiti. It was a country that seemed to be hopelessly mired in poverty. And yet, rather unexpectedly and unpredictably, it transformed itself into a wealthy, technologically advanced country with a culture, a popular culture that is of global significance. There is no other, the only example of a country transforming itself from poverty to a wealthy, technologically advanced. The only other case we have in the 20th century is Taiwan. And so Taiwan is also an amazing feat, but Taiwan has not made itself a global cultural power as South Korea. And that's an amazing thing too. I mean, South Korea was an unknown country. The only thing Americans knew about it was from mass television. And now it's, you know, K-pop everywhere, Korean television, movies, and it's just a major a center of global culture. To move from such obscurity to being a center stage in world culture, that's unprecedented. So I think there are really extraordinary histories of these two countries, and there are many things to ways we can explain about it. But what I wanted to point out in this book is that all the different economic studies about and social studies about South Korea and its development and the analysis of North Korea, they don't necessarily factor in to the extent that they should. The fact that these countries have been at war for 75 years is a major reason that they developed in such extreme ways. And I'll be happy to give you examples of this, but this is the larger point that I'm trying to make about this.
Oh, well, like, that's a good segue. Could you please, I mean, what are some of these examples that you think show this?
Okay. Now, let's take the problem of, let's look at South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
South Korea in the first decade after the Korean War in the 1950s, it was not making much economic progress. North Korea was the real success story. It went through rapid industrialization and development in the first decade after the Korean War. And this was very, very disturbing. So from a national security point of view, also it undermined the legitimacy of the South Korean regime. How could it say it's the true representative of the Korean nation when they're not delivering economically, when they are a poor country dependent on foreign aid? And North Korea is this dynamic, modern, industrializing country. So this was a major motivation for the military coup in 1961. And the military looked at it from a strategic point of view. If we're going to survive and compete with North Korea, we're going to have to industrialize really quickly too. So this was an added spur. I'm not saying it's the reason why South Korea developed, but it's a factor. And also another thing that may not be obvious is how initially in the 1960s, South Korea was actually influenced by what the North Koreans were doing. They launched 5-year plans. The Park Chung-hee regime wanted to emphasize heavy industry like the North Korea did that could be converted for military use. If one any proof of this, Park Chung-hee wrote very clearly that this was a national strategic need. We have to modernize and industrialize. We have no choice if we're going to survive as a nation. So that the competition was a spur to South Korea's development. Again, it's not the only reason it developed, nor does it explain why it was so successful, but it was an important factor. In the case of North Korea, there was the same idea. The North Koreans, after all, they only had a third of the population, although they had half the territory, and they lacked the historical capital. A Korea without Seoul is like a France without Paris. So they felt themselves in a somewhat inferior position and trying to promote themselves as the true Korea. And they need to demonstrate that they were by showing that their regime was successful. It could transform the half of Korea that it ruled into a proud, independent, advanced industrial nation. And that was a strong motivation of North Korea's industrialization as well. So, yeah, the rivalry between the two was extremely important in their development. I would add a couple of more things. The rivalry between the two was an excuse for authoritarian regimes in South Korea to crack down on dissent, and that's a rather ugly chapter in South Korea's history. The national security law, everything was national security. You're aiding the enemy by criticizing the regime. So North Korea, the rivalry between the South was also, and the fact that they were continually at war, was an excuse for authoritarian measures. In fact, North Korea, more than South Korea, has come to rely on the fact we are at war and the fighting will take place, could take place at any moment, as a way to keep the people isolated and disciplined and controlled.
So, I mean, where do you see, I guess, where do you see this conflict and its effect on the Korea's development going from here? I mean, first of all, I think I'm pretty sure people are not very optimistic that there'll be any kind of forward movement on inter-Korean relations, at least in the short term. People obviously talk about Kim Jong-un's younger sister maybe being the next number two. It's not clear what China's role is. But where do you see this relationship going over the next, let's say, 3-4 years?
Well, I think to answer that question might be useful to see how that relationship has changed. And it's changed in one fundamental way. From late 1940s up to maybe into the early 1980s, it was a rivalry between two regimes that both claimed to be the legitimate regime of all Koreans. But by the 1980s, North Korea's development stagnated. It became increasingly isolated in the world, just as South Korea's economic development was accelerating, and it was coming out in the world. If you want a turning point, you can say 1988 Olympics. Virtually every country in the world participated in it, and it was a great coming out party for South Korea. To show that we have arrived. And it came at a time when North Korea's economy was faltering. And then by the 1980s, North Korea's economy was so bad and such dire straits that people were speculating how long the regime could possibly survive, whereas South Korea just continued on modernizing and developing and, of course, and democratizing. So what you really see is that by some time, I would say, during the 1980s, it was no longer a rivalry between two regimes. It was South Korea forging ahead and North Korean regime trying to survive. And the sole purpose of the sole purpose today of the North Korean regime is to survive, to maintain itself, to keep from collapsing, to keep from being absorbed by South Korea, whatever else might happen, to keep the leaders from being overthrown, put on trial, hanged in the streets. They're just trying to survive. And this changes somewhat the nature. So South Korea doesn't, for South Korea, North Korea has become a problem, a kind of backward part of the country, politically unstable with a oppressive regime, a problem they have to deal with, but it's not a rival. There's no one that admires the North Korean regime. In fact, the great fear of South Korea now is that North Korea would collapse and they'd have to deal with 25 million impoverished compatriots that lack the skills that you need in a high-tech world. What would they do? This would probably overwhelm them. So actually, what's happened now, this is rather recent years, is that many South Koreans no longer want really unification or don't want it now, maybe in the distant future, but they really just want to find some way that North Korea could modernize and become less of a threat. Or an economic burden to them, should the regime fall. Mm.
Well, I think with that kind of forward look, I think it's a good place to end our conversation with Michael Seth, author of Korea at War. Michael, I actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work? And what's next for you? What do you think your next project might be?
I'm already working on it. So I have a book under contract now. It's a biography of Kim Il-sung.
Oh.
And I plan to, I actually haven't read it yet, but I have done the all the research and have the ideas working out in my head. So I plan to have the manuscript ready for the publisher by, you know, let's say by a year from now, I should be ready. So maybe in a year, you know, those things take a while. Sometimes publishers don't publish right away, but it should be out within the next 2 years. So that'll be my next book on Korea. I'm actually working on another book that has nothing to do with Korea, but I do write about other things. Mostly I write about Korea, but I do write about other things. I teach world history and I write on that. So that would be, that's the next thing. So people want to with Kim Il-sung, the North Korean founder. And as far as finding the book, well, I guess on Amazon, it should be out. It's called Korea War, published by Tuttle. It should be available on Amazon.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network and NewBooksNetwork.com. We're on all of your podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Stay tuned for more news who's coming up on the show. But before then, Michael, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.